First up this afternoon on The Lead is a story out of the Star Tribune about the sharp increase that we're seeing in uses of the electronic scooters and e-bikes downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul, and actually around the Twin Cities as a whole. And so we reached out to Dylan Freed, who's the Mobility and Curbside Access Manager with the City of Minneapolis, and I asked him, as he joins us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline, Dylan, what exactly do you think is causing this spike in ridership?
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of factors that go into this. The two primary ones that we think are driving this are both an increase in vehicle availability. So we've worked with both of our two providers, with Lime and Spin, to increase the number of both shared scooters and shared bikes throughout the city. And so that increase in vehicle availability is part of what's leading to more rides. The other primary cause, we think, is as the city builds out our bicycle network, especially our all ages and abilities network, where, you know, with protected bike lanes and whatnot, more people feel comfortable riding in those facilities as well. So both the combination of infrastructure and vehicle availability, we feel, is what's driving the increases that we're seeing in ridership.
You mentioned comfort, and that's one of the things. I've tried these a couple of times, the scooter specifically, and one of the things that I was concerned about is that I just didn't know what the rules are in terms of, do these things need to be on the street? Are they on sidewalks? Sidewalks seems like kind of a dangerous place for some of them, although I saw two guys today on the sidewalk and then getting into a bike lane on them. What exactly are the rules for where these things are supposed to go?
Yeah, so they are not supposed to be operated on the sidewalks. That is an ongoing issue, you know, we're aware of. We include surveys that actually ask people, you know, are you aware that you're not supposed to ride on the sidewalk? And some people genuinely are not, but some of them are. But even if they are aware they're not supposed to ride on the sidewalk, they often say that they don't feel safe or comfortable riding the street. And so that's part of why, you know, as we see more protected bike lanes throughout the city, we do feel that more people are using them and comfortable using them. But yeah, any of the shared e-scooters and e-bikes, they can legally be ridden on any city street. But you know, most people prefer the spaces with designated bike lanes and whatnot, where it's more comfortable to ride.
Are they covered by any helmet laws, either by the city or by the state?
Yeah, so the state of Minnesota does not have helmet laws, but they're highly encouraged.
Okay. So. In terms of finding these and using these, as I understand it, it's all app-based, right, in terms of both locating their where they're at and then, you know, turning them on and getting them used. How do people go about, if somebody's curious about this but doesn't honestly have any clue where to start, what's a good way for folks to find out more about, you know, how to get on the apps and how to use them?
Sure, yeah. The City of Minneapolis, we have two licensed providers in our city. The first one is Lime. The second one is Spin. And so anyone can just download those apps onto their phone, either the Lime app or the Spin app. And once you're in those providers' apps, you may need to set up a profile. But from there, it'll bring up a map of the city, and you can see on that map where any of their shared bikes and scooters are located. And so that's really handy if you're, you know, hopefully you don't need to walk more than a block or so in any direction, but it'll depend on where you are in the city and kind of what the density of vehicles are around you. They do have tips, especially for new users. They have new rider tips and that you have to go through to kind of help you understand the rules and understand some of the best practices in riding the vehicles.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Dylan Freed, Mobility and Curbside Access Manager at City of Minneapolis. We appreciate it and encourage folks, if you're looking at different ways to try and get around the city, this is definitely one that you can take advantage of for a relatively cheap price. That's story number one on The Lead. Story number two, the St. Paul Saints are renewing their push. They're trying to build a Ferris wheel near CHS Field in Lower Town St. Paul. And so, of course, that means we're going to reach out to St. Paul Saints Executive Vice President Tom Whaley on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. And Tom, thanks for joining me. You know, it's difficult these days to get money out of the state legislature. There's all kinds of budgetary issues. In the last session when you guys tried this, what is it that makes you think that in the next session you guys are able to gather this much funding from the state?
Well, first thing, we respect that and enjoy being part of the process. It's important, I think, you know, it's incumbent on us as a as an entertainment venue in St. Paul to always keep looking for that next big thing. And what can we do to keep our tourism? We believe this will be a regional attraction. What can we do to keep moving that ball forward? It's really a never ending job. And this seemed like a next logical step. The market doesn't have anything like it. We feel comfortable in operating it, and it's a, it provides a really great vision for attraction in St. Paul.
Chicago has something like this. St. Louis has something like this, and they've seen a fair bit of success. Do you think the success that they've had translates to St. Paul? Is that something you can show legislators and say, hey, look, this is a good investment?
Yes. Yeah, we've talked to, I think the key to remember also, it's part of a project that also includes, it happens to be in the same area as the ballpark. We need to expand our visiting locker room facilities to keep up with Major League Baseball standards. So it's a, there are two aspects to the project. But yes, as the Ferris wheel on its own, we're cognizant of the challenges, but it now's the right time. And we looked at St. Louis, we looked at Chicago, talked to those folks about, you know, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities. And so we've done homework on it. And yes, we believe we'll be able to present a really solid picture for legislators.
One of the things the Saints have always been great at is thinking outside the box. And with the world having essentially been turned upside down in the last 5 years, that kind of out-of-the-box thinking is more necessary than ever. And so, yeah, we want to keep areas like Lower Town vital and downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul and all of these areas vital and fresh, but it requires new ideas to do that, and this seems like something that, you know, fits that kind of description.
Yes, it does. We think it does, and you're right. It is about vibrancy. It's about offering folks in this a reason to want to live here, for young people to want to relocate here, or folks to stay here. It's a never ending. I don't want to say a battle because we have a ton of fun doing it, but it really, the job never ends. You can't just sit back and rest on what you have, and so we are. And of course, we're looking to expand on the partnership that built the ballpark originally. So the Saints will be part of the funding solution as well. We expect to be part of that. It's been a really great partnership.
You mentioned, rules and regulations of Major League Baseball and how that goes into updating the area around the ballpark. What has the relationship with the Twins been like for the Saints? I assume that's been a net positive for you guys.
Absolutely. The Twins are an absolute top shelf organization to work with. And it goes predates our days as a Triple A team with them. The Twins, we've always had a wonderful relationship. Dave St. Peter and all the folks over there have been great friends to us and whatnot. It was a natural that we came together. But yeah, it's been if there's a word that it's stronger than positive, it's been a net that.
Very good. Very good. Well, you know, I'm not somebody that's necessarily afraid of heights. As long as I have some sort of enclosure around me, I'm good being up high. So let's get this Ferris wheel built, and I'm coming over and taking a ride for sure. Thank you so much.
It's climate controlled, too. So
perfect.
You can come in the winter,
love
too.
That. Love that. Tom Whaley, Executive Vice President for the St. Paul Saints. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Story number three on the lead here on this Monday afternoon. Lindsay, I thought this one would be of particular interest to you. Being the massive hockey person that you are, the Stanley Cup is coming back to Minnesota. No, not courtesy of the Minnesota Wild. This is courtesy of Nate Schmidt, who played at the U, grew up in St. Cloud, and was part of the Florida Panthers squad that won the Stanley Cup. He's bringing it back to his hometown of St. Cloud 1 week from today. So Monday, there'll be a gathering at the MAC, and the public will get a chance to get their picture taken with it. Doors will open at 11 a.m., and you should be able to start getting your picture taken with it around noon. Now, you've told me before the show you actually already have a picture with the Cup.
I had a VIP date with the Stanley Cup during my time in Vegas, because as you know, the Vegas Golden Knights won a championship a couple years ago. So before they secured that championship, that cup was brought to my former place of employment, the radio station. And so I got to take a picture, interview one of the guys who gets paid to just take flights with it all the time. There's actually a whole staff of them that do
Isn't
this.
Isn't there like a keeper of the cup?
Yeah, the keeper of the cup.
Yeah.
They're actually including women now. There's two women on staff.
About
it took
time.
I mean, you know.
You wanted to keep
and
the thing
so,
clean.
And so it's very cold. It's very large. And it is very bright. And speaking of brightness, there's no brighter person in the NHL except for probably Marc-Andre Fleury, the Nate Schmidt. And I had the pleasure of covering both of them during their time with the Vegas Golden Knights before Nate. I think it was he was traded to Vancouver, and he kind of bumped around for the last couple years. He was in Winnipeg, but then ultimately ended up being one of those pieces on the defensive end for the Florida Panthers. Very exciting thing for him and his family and for the legacy that he has certainly built as a hockey player, but he's a wonderful person and the golden retriever of the NHL.
There you go. He says, I've been thinking about this my whole life, where I would want to take the cup if I ever won, and to be able to take it back to a place where it not only shaped me as a player, but as a person as well. It's why I'm so excited to take it back to St. Cloud, where it all started. Winning the Stanley Cup has been the most surreal experience, surpassing anything I've ever dreamt about. Answer me this quickly, because we do have to take a break before we get to page two. How the heck is it that a team in Miami and a team in Las Vegas have won a Stanley Cup before a team in Minnesota?
Income taxes.
Where's the state of hockeyness now? Come on.
The taxes. We like our sidewalks here, right?
That's
sidewalks or championships. What do you want?
North Stars move out of town. They win a cup. Come on, Wild.
That was like 90. That was in 96, so many years since. Won't you take pride in Jake Oettinger if he should bring one home as well?
I would take pride if the Wild won one.
Okay.
Can we just do that? Well,
let's just sign Kirill first, and then we'll see where that gets us, huh?
That's the lead here. Coming up next, after the break, it will do page two. And in page two, we all hate the political ads, but our friends over in Hudson will tell you they've started already. That and more coming up right after this break. You're listening to 830 WCCO. We continue with the DeRush Hour headlines and look at what's this on page two. We start with ads for Wisconsin governor's race. The governor's race that's in 2026, by the way. Yes, they've already started. Can you believe that? November of 2026, they're voting for a governor in Wisconsin like we are here in Minnesota. But they've already started with the political ads. More than a year ahead of balloting, Republican candidate Bill Berrien announced the purchase of about $400,000 in cable TV, radio, and online ads Monday. The buy comes 13 months before the August 11, 2026 primary. So almost a full year before the primary. Berrien is the first candidate to purchase ads of any kind in the race. Berrien and Washington County Executive Josh Schumann have announced bids as Republicans. It's the first campaign for each of them. Several other Republicans, including U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany, two-time losing U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde, and State Senate President Mary Felskowski, pretty sure I got that right, are all considering running. Quote, money buys ads, but as we've seen far too often in Wisconsin, it can't buy wins, one of the advisors said. It takes hard work and authenticity to earn voter support and not just slick ads. Look, if ads didn't work, they wouldn't be spending 400 grand on them. You know, we all holler and whine about political ads. We don't like them, right? That's why I chose this story. Can you believe the ads are starting already and we're over a year to the election? But they do it because it works. They're not spending that kind of money because they don't work, right? So we all say that we hate them, and yet it moves the needle. And yes, you know, other stuff, hard work and ground game and all that other things that you hear about when it comes to
door
politics.
Door to door, pound the pavement.
No, that's all important. That's all important. But like I said, they're not spending close to $500,000 this early because the ads don't do anything.
What about the flyers, though? The brochures?
I'm guessing those aren't costing 400 grand. Maybe I don't know.
Our subconscious is under assault.
I don't know. Another gold rush is coming. I don't know if you heard about this, Lindsay. Another gold rush is coming, this time to South Dakota.
You don't say.
Now, Gold Rush brought settlers to South Dakota's Black Hills roughly 150 years ago, chasing the dream of wealth and displacing Native Americans in the process. Don't talk about that so much. Now, a new crop of miners driven by gold prices, which are at more than $3,000 an ounce, are seeking to return to the treasure landscape, promising an economic boost while raising fears of how modern gold extraction could forever change the region. Quote, these impacts can be made long term and it can make it so that tourism and outdoor recreation is negatively impacted. That according to Lilius Jarding, executive director of the Black Hills Clean Water Alliance. Gee, I wonder what side he's on. Quote, our enjoyment of the Black Hills as a peaceful place and a sacred place is disturbed. The Black Hills, of course, encompasses over 1.2 million acres rising up from the Great Plains in southwest South Dakota and extending into Wyoming. Jagged peaks are similar to those of the Rocky Mountains, but the lush pine-covered hills are sacred to the Lakota Sioux, and serve as a destination for millions of tourists who visit Mount Rushmore and other state parks. There's only one gold mine now operating in the Black Hills, but companies have proposals before state and federal agencies for another one, plus exploratory drilling sites that they hope will lead to full-fledged mines. And that's led all kinds of opposition from Native Americans and environmentalists and folks that are saying this is too close to sacred sites and will contaminate waterways and permanently scar the landscape. It's the same kind of arguments that folks have been having up around the Iron Range when they're talking about more mining closer to the Boundary Waters area.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of deal.
I hate it.
I mean, yeah.
I hate mining. I hate people digging for gold. There's like some show in Australia where they're digging for gold, and the amount of destruction they go through just to find this special dust is bizarre to me. All of it's sacred to me.
I mean, if somebody had held a widget up in front of you and said, if you dig often enough, this widget's worth $3,000 and you can find a whole bunch of these widgets, you'd be tempted by just the general idea. Now, you know, wherever it is and the effect that it has on the environment, that's a whole other thing. But you can understand $3,000 an ounce where people are at least interested in this.
Well, it says a lot about the strength of the American dollar, if you ask me.
Well, there's that. There's that. We're going to skip that next story. We're going to get to the last story here.
Okay.
Which is, rest in peace, Chancellor Valorum.
The point is conceded. Will you defer your motion to allow a commission to explore the validity of your accusations?
I will not defer. I've come before you to resolve this attack on our sovereignty now.
That's the voice of actor Terrence Stamp. You may not know that name, but if you Google and look a picture of him, you will know who this is. He's an English actor whose piercing presence defined villains and heroes alike in films such as Superman and The Limey, and he's passed away at age 87. That was, of course, Chancellor Valorum in the Star Wars prequels. A statement from Stamp's family said he died Sunday. The actor also gave acclaimed performances in British cinema across decades, keeping his standards when choosing roles up though and not impossibly high. Quote, I don't do crappy movies, he said, unless I haven't got the rent. That seems pretty pragmatic. You know, that's kind of, after his run as a leading man, Stamp embraced character roles, and those appearances included The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, playing a transgender woman, a performance often cited as a standout despite mixed reviews for the film. In 1999, he starred in Steven Soderbergh's The Limey. His later work included Last Night in Soho, a film set in the 1960s in London. That period also kicked off a drought that didn't end until Superman, he told The Guardian in 2015. When the 1960 ended, I just ended with it. He said, I remember my agent telling me they're all looking for a young Terrence Stamp. But he was no longer young. Passed away at age 87. Again, he's one of those guys.
He's one of the old guys that does evil real well. I knew him from other films like Get Smart, which is kind of that play on a spy movie with Steve Carell and Anne Hathaway. Here's that clip.
I understand that you're the man to see if someone is interested in acquiring items of a nuclear nature.
How do I know you're not Control?
If I were Control, you'd already be dead.
If you were Control, you'd already be dead.
Well, neither of us is dead, so I'm obviously not from Control.
That actually makes sense.
He's, again, you see a picture of the guy, you'll know immediately who he is. He's been in 1,000 different movies and TV roles, and the name, if you had put him in front of me, I would have gone, oh, that's the guy that played General Zod, and that's the guy that did Chancellor Valorum. I could not in a million tries have told you what his name was. And to a degree, I think that's almost a testament to him, that he was so good that he's in all these different things, but he didn't ever have to be the guy necessarily whose name you had to know. So testament to his skill anyway. That's page two. We'll take a break. Come back, we'll check traffic and weather, and then Dave Schwartz, who joins us on Mondays to talk sports. Gee, I wonder what we might discuss with Dave. That's coming up next. You're listening to 830 WCCO. Dan Cook in for Jason DeRusha on this Monday afternoon. Lindsay, was I supposed to bring snacks for this? I didn't realize that was part of the bit. I don't remember there being snacks involved.
I ate them already.
Oh, no. Joined now by Dave Schwartz.
Jason brings me to lunch occasionally.
Ah, is that what it is? Okay. All right.
Yeah, occasionally.
McDonald's? Is that usually what it is? Does that work? Is that okay? On my producer salary, I can't afford the places Jason
I'll
likes to
it.
Eat. So,
yep, I'll take what I can get.
This is Dave Schwartz with the Minnesota Wild. Joins us every Monday. And back returning from the wilderness, was it moose or elk that you were hunting? I forget exactly how this how this worked.
I was hunting the wildest game of all, mosquitoes.
Ooh. Yeah, they've been particularly bad this year, haven't they?
Oh, I tried to figure this out because we were up north at scout camp, which is just out north of it's many points for any scout enthusiasts out there who know that camp. And what's so interesting to me is that during the day, you would get the black flies, and they were vicious.
Oh,
and
they're terrible.
Your sock.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if they have a deal with the mosquitoes, that the black flies will take, you know, 8 in the morning to about 6:30 in the evening, and then they're off the clock, and the mosquitoes come in, and then they crush humans up and through the morning. I mean, you get no break, and they're just all over you all the time. Other than that, it was a lovely experience.
Yeah, sounds wonderful. Can't imagine why more people wouldn't want to do that. Nice of the bugs to work in shifts. That was very efficient
the
of them.
Makes the dream work.
Very nice. Very nice. We're going to start with the Minnesota Twins, Dave, and I'm going to start with the positive news. And you might not think that there is any, but I'm going to bring some anyway. And that was the induction yesterday of Corey Koski into the Twins Hall of Fame. And I got a lot of people asking me over the weekend. It was kind of remarkable to me. They were reacting kind of like, really? Corey Koski is in the Twins Hall of Fame? And I said, I think people have forgotten just how good he was when he was here. Gary Gaetti, I'm sure, is probably the best third baseman in Twins history. But, I mean, Corey was right, offensively especially, Corey was right there behind him.
Yeah, he was a clutch hitter, from what I mean, not necessarily, you know, a power guy. He could get a home run for you when needed, but a guy that would just, he was solid, you know, and you just knew that he would come through in the clutch. And, you know, you look at his batting average over the season, you know, not amazing, but a couple of seasons with the Twins where he hit over 300. And then obviously played a little bit in Toronto, Milwaukee, but what I remember when I think of grittiness and tough players, I think of Corey Koski. You know, that's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but he had some concussion issues, I believe.
Yeah, he did with Milwaukee, and that's what actually ended his career.
Near the end. But other than that, I mean, he was a rock-solid player and a guy who just always brought toughness to your lineup, would do what you needed to get the job done. And I don't see any reason why you wouldn't think of him as a Twins Hall of Famer, because he was solid for them for a very long time.
Right. Never mind the fact that, you know, a team Hall of Fame is entirely subjective and you make up whatever rules for putting people in you want. I don't think there's really, my favorite thing about Corey Koski was the way that he developed himself as a defensive player. And this was always, I've gotten over my old school baseballness of thinking the designated hitter is the worst thing in the world. But I don't like knowing what, like, Corey Koski's trajectory, where he came up and he wasn't a terribly good defensive third baseman, and it's why Tom Kelly didn't play him as much when he first debuted. Yeah. But he and Ron Gardenhier got together and went out to third base every day and hit 1,000 grounders to him until he made himself into a passable and then a little bit above average defensive third baseman. And it's what drives me nuts about young guys who, you know, wind up in that designated hitter role is you can make yourself at least passable at the big league level defensively enough to justify, you know, your offensive prowess. And the fact that a lot of guys don't do that just kind of drives me nuts.
I would also add to that in the designated hitter role, people don't quite understand just how difficult that job is.
True.
And how difficult that role is. If you're a guy who's getting 3 at-bats a night, 3 to 4 at-bats a night, you're getting in the rhythm, you're figuring it out. As a DH, it's like, okay, bud, you're in. You haven't touched, you haven't seen a big league swing here, maybe in a day or two, and you got to go in and be clutch. And that designated hitter role is a role that, for my money, people don't quite understand just how tough it is to just get up there and say, okay, go get us a hit right now. We need it.
All the more reason I would argue that, you know, if you go out and do a little bit of work, you can make yourself into a decent first baseman, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And be a player that gets a more every, you know, are you more in the flow of the game, and, you know, that the difficulties of being the designated hitter isn't such a thing for you anymore. I don't know. Okay. Now the bad news. You've seen this team struggle for, you know, the last, year and a half or so. I think Aaron Gleeman did an article today on The Athletic talking about that as of last August 17th, the Twins had the American League's fourth best record at 70-53. Yeah. They've played 163 games since then, and they've gone 70-93.
Yeah.
It's the second worst record in the AL ahead of only the Chicago White Sox. And of course that led to the big fire sale at the trade deadline. And I think folks were mostly, you know, treading water there. There's some folks that were upset about it. But there was always this thought that there was change coming at the ownership level, and that that would turn a page anyway, and hopefully, you know, move into a new era of Twins baseball. What was your reaction last Wednesday when you heard the news that the Pollads were going to be remaining in ownership of the Twins?
I was hoping you were going to ask me about this. I really was, because I don't know that everyone shares my opinion, and that's certainly okay. But for people out there who are angry that the Pollads are staying, or angry and want to blame the Pollads for everything that's gone wrong, you're just not seeing the bigger picture here of what an organization is structured like. The Pollads, they're not the ones that are going to evaluate talent and develop that talent and make them big league players. That's not the Pollads' job. It's not what they do. That's to your scouts. That's to your minor league managers. That's to your major league managers to identify the draft and then develop that talent. That has nothing to do with ownership. Ownership's job is to pony up the money when needed. Should they have gone out and maybe gotten a couple of free agents over the years and spent some more money? Sure. Why not? But would that have made all the difference? Ask yourself, at any time in the last, let's just say 5 years, were the Twins just one or two players away from making the World Series? No way. So this idea that the Pollads are responsible for everything that's gone wrong with this organization, to me, it is a cop-out. It's not just the Pollads. If they, let's just say they had the money, like, you know what, we're going to go get Shohei Ohtani. We are going to just put everything on top of our heads, and everyone's going to be surprised. We're getting Ohtani. Is he the one that's going to put this team any better than they are now by a couple of games? Yes, maybe. Is it going to change everything? Absolutely not. So this idea, again, that everything's gone wrong with the Pollads, and when I saw, okay, they're back in with ownership, okay, it doesn't change anything for me. What they need to do, though, is figure out at the heart of the problem here, what's going on? Why aren't they drafting the right people? Or why aren't they developing into the way that they want them to? That's the bigger issue here. It's not ownership. It's the player. It's the staff inside the organization that is not drafting or developing the players the way they should be.
You know, and I'm mostly with you on that. I guess, you know, what the pushback would be, right, is that who hired the people that are doing all that stuff, right? I mean, ultimately, the buck sort of does stop with ownership in terms of hiring a Derek Falvey or, you know, or okaying the hiring of Rocco Baldelli or wherever you want to put the blame for this collapse. That still does land at the ownership's feet. And beyond that, I guess, as I look at it, trying to be objective about it, I think it's hard to not argue that there's been a breach in the relationship between ownership and fans. The fans don't trust this ownership group, rightly or wrongly. And I think all the points that you just made are spot on. The fans clearly do not trust this group. And my concern is, even if you make moves in the quote unquote right direction in the next season or two, folks just aren't going to show up. And it, you know, attendance already kind of trending in the wrong direction. That's going to be a big problem.
Yes. But yes, I don't disagree with you. But winning cures all of that. If they have the players in there that win games, people will come back to the ballpark. And I have talked to so many general managers in different sports and things like that. And they'll all tell you the same thing. If they made decisions based on fans, the franchise would be a disaster, because you simply can't do it. The average fan, and I'm not trying to insult anybody, but the average fan who thinks they know a lot about baseball still does not know it at the level that some of these GMs and scouts and people do. And so you can't make decisions based on just simply based on fans, because what happens? As soon as you start winning, they're coming back. And you could spend all the money in the world and go get everybody else, but if you're losing, they're not coming to the ballpark. And I do also think that it would be silly to discount the fact that in the state that we're in right now as a country, purchases like tickets, season tickets, luxury items, those are often the first thing to go when economic times are tough. And I think you look across industry here, it's tough right now. People are not spending that kind of money. So part of it is that, but the bigger portion is the team's just not winning. You win ballgames, people come back. That's what you got to do.
We got to take a break. He's Dave Schwartz. I'm Dan Cook, sitting in for Jason DeRussia. We'll update you on traffic and weather and have a little bit more with Dave coming up next. You're listening to 830 WCCO. Continuing talking sports with Dave Schwartz, who joins us every Monday here on Drive Time with DeRussia. We got a couple minutes left here, Dave. Vikings lose to the Patriots in their second preseason game. None of the starters play. I don't I don't know, should we care about this game at all? Is there anything there we should be paying attention to? What's going on?
I mean, it's interesting. I think Gopher fans will find it interesting that where the backup quarterback race is kind of heating up. There are a lot of people now and a lot of teams behind the idea that Max Brosmer could end up actually making the roster and possibly be in there as the third QB. Watching a couple of his, I think it was one or two of his series that he played against the Patriots. He looks good. I was impressed with some of his passes. He puts the ball where he needs to be. A nice throw, outthrow to I think it was Tim Jones. Really nice back shoulder throw. What's interesting to me about Max Brosmer is his trajectory. And,
yeah,
you know, some of these quarterbacks that are there, you kind of know what they are already, right? You know what Brett Rippon's going to be. You know what Sam Howell's going to be. Max Brosmer is interesting. 2 years ago, he was playing 1AA. And he comes into a new offense with a new coach, learns all of it, succeeds very well last year for the Gophers. So, you know, it's kind of an investment, right? You see this guy, his stock is rising pretty quickly. And I think Kevin O'Connell likes the idea of maybe seeing where this kid's ceiling is. And that's kind of exciting for them to have that option. Just in case, because you never know what's going to happen at the quarterback position.
Spoken like a true preseason football addict. I love it. Thank you so much for that. Because the bottom line is, obviously, if this team has to count on Max Brosmer to win games for them at some point, the season's gone horribly awry. Go ahead.
The same could have been said about Taylor Heineke, and I'm just saying. Anyway, go ahead.
We only have about a minute left, and I do want to get to this, because the Lynx are now undefeated without their MVP candidate. Have we overrated Fee at this point? I mean, the team is buzzing right along without it. This team should win a championship this year, right?
They should. I don't think I don't necessarily think it's that she's not important.
I'm joking about the overrated, yes.
Yes, they have enough people on the bench and around that Cheryl has gotten coaxed up to the point where they can tread water, win some games, although they have won games against good teams. You know, the New York
Yeah, three in a row against New York, right?
I mean, she's certainly still very important, but it's always good to know that you've got some insurance if someone goes down.
We got to wrap it up, Dave. Thanks so much. Appreciate the time. Jason's back tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody.